Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and really happy to have back a couple of our regular guests. One of them, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Brian, great to have you back.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Lisa Johnson, good to see her smiling face, too. She's back with us. Lisa is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. Lisa, hi there. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Larry. Good to see you.
So as we listen to these two experts talk, I hope you'll join in with your questions. What gardening questions are on your mind? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. And, of course, we would love to hear from you. Brian, let's start with you. What kinds of problems do you see as we relate to planting trees and shrubs, or maybe improper planting of trees and shrubs?
I have to say, because of COVID and doing a lot more with digital photos, I've gotten a better think actually goes back to when they were planted. A lot of situations where the trees or shrubs have been planted too deeply, they've subsequently developed things like girdling roots. These are roots that grow around the trunk and then eventually kind of constrict the water conducting tissue inside the tree. And that causes a lot of dieback and poor foliage and a variety of problems. And then we have situations where bald and burlap materials, they have not removed the burlap or the wire basket, or in the worst possible scenario, there's oftentimes a twine or a wire that connects the wire basket to the trunk of the tree. And if that's not removed, and I have seen that, that will eventually girdle the main trunk. So it's just a whole mass of issues with plantings and then subsequent care where people just aren't watering enough after these trees and shrubs have been planted to keep them alive.
Yeah, so there's lots going on. You get rid of all of that stuff that may be around the roots and then plant it at, talk about where you plant, how you plant.
My recommendation is to have what's called the root flare at the soil line. So that's the part of the trunk where it widens to form the roots, able to see that above the soil. And oftentimes that's buried. And if you get in bald and burlap materials, oftentimes the bald and burlap tree or shrub comes with that area of the trunk or the crown buried already. So you have to remove some soil to get down to that before you plant. And then the big thing is proper watering. I advocate for roughly 3 years, sometimes longer if you're planting really huge trees, but roughly 3 years or so, about 2 inches of water per week. And that starts when the trees start to bud out in the spring for deciduous trees and shrubs up until the fall when they start to turn their normal fall color. But for evergreens, even later in the fall, up until the point where either the ground freezes or we get a significant snowfall, because those evergreens are using water even when it gets relatively cool. And you don't want them to dehydrate over the winter time. So that's something we see quite commonly.
Yeah. And Lisa, do we fertilize, not fertilize? What do we do in those when we plant?
Usually it's recommended that you don't fertilize the first year. And I know that a lot of companies will, you know, give you fertilizer packets and suggest that you do that. But the research from our woody plant specialist says that that should not be done. Now, young trees, you know, a year or even 2 years after they've been planted, you can do some fertilizing. Usually mature trees don't need it, which is a whole separate issue, of course, from nutritional issues that might be caused by pH, for example, the measure of acidity or alkalinity of the soil. I think Brian and I have both probably seen chlorosis issues this year, particularly things like pin oaks or river birch that are in soil that's too alkaline for them. And that causes a nutritional deficiency because the elements in question, usually iron or manganese, are not available as soluble in alkaline soils. So that does cause a nutritional issue, and you have to correct the underlying pH, which is tough if you live in southern Wisconsin, where we're underlain by limestone, and there's a heck of a lot of calcium carbonate in the soil, so it's really hard to change pH. And so sometimes those trees are just not planted in the right place.
And you need to know which nutrient is a problem. Lisa mentioned iron and manganese. I've had situations where when the soil pH is high, a particular tree may be deficient in manganese, but people are more familiar with an iron deficiency with high soil pH. So they give the tree a lot of iron, and iron and manganese compete for uptake. So when you add more iron, that actually that's taken up, and you make the problem worse. So it's very important to know exactly which nutrients are involved. And quite frankly, as Lisa mentioned, deal with the underlying problem, which is the soil pH issue.
Yeah. On my little 3-mile hike this morning around the neighborhood, I was looking at some of the new trees, relatively young trees that have been put in. Most of them are staked. Should we be staking those trees?
That's a question that is an answer of it depends. many times we don't advocate doing that. Now, this is different from fruit trees. Fruit trees should be usually staked, young trees anyway. But shade trees, in general, we want to make sure that they have the ability to move a little bit in the wind, because that will add to their girth, and it will help beef up the root flare area, as well as just, you know, add to the general girth. It'll make them stronger and so on. But if these are young trees in an area, for example, that's on a street where there might be, you know, some vandalism, where they're in the tree terrace, or if it's in a really windy area, then you might want to stake it for a year. But usually for homeowners, if it's possible, we usually don't recommend doing that. For one reason, people forget to take those stakes off, and then you get just horrible problems with girdling, or that they use the wrong type of materials. They use a wire or garden hose, or what you want is something that's flat and wide, something kind of like seatbelt material. And they do sell that at a lot of the nurseries and garden centers with a handy dandy grommet already in it, so that you don't have anything abrading the trunk. And often I have seen too, just the actual staking not done correctly, stake run through the root ball. It should be outside the root ball. Sometimes you also see several different supports, and you only need a couple. So,
yeah. So there's, one more thing relating to planting is the time of the year. I mean, you've got a heat spell or whatever. Is it okay to plant trees and shrubs in the heat of summer?
It's not ideal, for sure.
Yeah.
But sometimes that's what happens if you've got like a tree planting event set up. Certainly if you have the option, it's definitely better to do it in the spring or in the fall. But, you know, a lot of these trees are, you know, if they're well taken care of in a nursery, they're bald and burlap, they've got, plenty of root and so on. Ideally, again, you would not plant during a drought, but if you had to, you could, but it's
just
not
water.
Ideal. Yeah.
Please water. Please water.
Water in the hole before you put the tree in. And then what I usually do as I'm planting is, of course, after removing all of the bald and burlap stuff and any wire and so on, you've spread out your roots. And I will, as I'm putting it in, I'll usually fill the soil about a third, or the hole a third with soil, water that, let it go down, put another third in, water it again, you know, so that you're eliminating any air pockets and so that you know that the whole soil profile has gotten water.
Well, planting, Pauline in New Berlin has a question, I think, relating to planting a plant. Let's go to Pauline and see what's on her mind. Hi, Pauline.
Hi, good morning. I have a hydrangea that's still in the pot, and I plan on putting it in the ground this weekend. And it's called Pinky Winky, and I'm wondering if the tag says sun or part shade. Do you have any idea which would be better, full sun or part shade, part sun? And is it deer resistant?
Okay. I can address the sun full shade. I'm not sure about deer resistant. We do have a publication at the Learning Store that's called Plants Not Favored by Deer, which does not necessarily mean that the deer won't eat it. But that would be a good place to start. So Pinky Winky is a panicle hydrangea. There are a number of different varieties out there. They're really beautiful shrubs. They bloom later in the season, so usually in July or August. And big, gorgeous teardrop-shaped panicles of flowers that bloom on new wood. So you can prune that in the spring without worrying that you're going to nail any of the flowers because they haven't been produced yet. Now, you don't want to wait too late to do that. But regarding planting of it, it's best if you can have it in more sun. But that being said, they can take up to a half a day of shade and still bloom really well. So I would look at any other factors, like is the place that you're planning on putting it, if in full sun, is it really hot and dry? But the partly shaded place is a little bit better in terms of moisture, then I'd go for the partly shaded place. But if the full sun area is fine in terms of soil, you don't have any utilities around that you have to worry about. You're not having it next to a sidewalk where you might apply salt for the winter. Anything like that, those are things that you should think about. These do, by the way, get pretty big. I've got a Pinky Winky in my yard, so I usually do prune it back because otherwise it's 6-7 feet tall and it's a little bit bigger than my tiny bit of real estate can accommodate.
I did check that publication, Lisa, and hydrangea does not show up on the Plants Not Favored by Deer. So I would assume that the deer will munch on it.
Yeah. Thank you for checking that.
Yeah. It's if you go to the Learning Store website. Yeah, if you go to the Learning Store website, it's A3727 is the publication number.
Yeah, and if you just type in UW-Madison Learning Store, it'll pop up in your search engine. So there you go. Thank you, Pauline. Betty in Dubuque, Iowa, your turn. Hi, Betty.
Hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Well, we live in Dubuque, and we have a big old cottonwood tree at the end of our property, and the neighbor's going to cut it down. So we need to plant a shade tree. It's all lawn, and we have clay soil, and I want some suggestions for what kind of a shade tree for Dubuque. And we're just north of Highway 20 in Dubuque.
So what kinds of things do you like about trees? Are you looking for something that flowers? Are you looking for fall color? Are you looking for something you can harvest nuts from? Something that'll...
No, I don't want any nuts because we have enough squirrels around here.
okay. Good place to start.
I want a tree that's easy maintenance. We don't want fruit because the deer will eat them. I just need a nice, fall colors is pretty, but just a nice shade tree that will do well in our climate here.
Okay.
Okay.
So what do you...
So almost, you know, all trees are going to produce some kind of fruit because that includes seeds. So with maples, unless you get a male, you're going to get the little helicopter-like maple seedlings. And actually, even males can sometimes produce a few seeds. One you might want to try, it's going to be slower growing, but there are a number of ginkgo trees that you have to get a male. If you get a female, it's going to produce fruit if there happens to be a male in the vicinity to pollinate it. But if you get a male, it should not produce fruit. There are a number of nice ones out there. I'm particularly fond of Presidential Gold, but there are certainly other male ginkgo varieties out there. They have beautiful fall color, yellow, and they are slow growing, however. Another one you might want to look at is Kentucky coffee tree, and you want to make sure to get a male of those too, because otherwise you get these big seed pods. But there's a variety called Espresso that you might want to look at. That one doesn't get much in the way of fall color, but it is a beautiful tree. There are certainly any number of maples. I'm always a big advocate of tree diversity, and there are a lot of maples out there, which is why I recommended the other two first in order to try and get more tree diversity out there. But any of the Freeman maples, I'm not as fond of Autumn Blaze because it has some weaker crotch angles that can sometimes tend to cause some issues, but there are some other varieties out there. And, you know, being in Dubuque, you have a lot of varieties available to you that we don't have here in Wisconsin because we're a little bit colder. So it's...
So there are plenty of options.
Many more than that out there.
Yeah. What would you think of a hackberry, Lisa?
Yeah, hackberry would be another good one. The one problem with hackberry is that it does tend to get nipple gall. If your soil is alkaline, you can end up with chlorosis. But speaking of which, if your soil is not alkaline, river birch is a beautiful shade tree that's fast growing. Not much in the way of fall color, but we do have a beautiful publication by Dr. Laura Gell on the Learning Store that I'm trying to remember the title, Brian, but it's something like Selecting Landscape Plants. And so if you just look for UW Learning Store and type in Selecting Landscape Plants, it goes from everything to fall color to size to everything you'd want to know.
Yeah. Selecting woody landscape plants for fall color.
Okay, that's one. But there's another one, too, that's more general. But the fall color one is great, too.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you so much for calling, Betty. Appreciate it. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Lisa Johnson, one of our guests, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston, our guests today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Lots of callers online and some good emails. Here's an email from Johnny in Marquette County. Wonders how far away he should plant his plant from his foundation. He has maples 8 feet away from the foundation of his house. 8 feet's pretty close. Yeah, he's wondering if he should be concerned. It seems pretty close to me.
Yeah, that is really pretty close. Ideally, it would be something more like 20 feet or even more, depending on the type of maple, of course. You know, if it's like a smaller Japanese maple, that might be okay. But maples tend to have pretty shallow roots as well. And that's just way yeah. too close.
Yeah, for sure. Speaking of maple roots, Vivian in Deerfield, Illinois has something relating to that. Hi, Vivian.
Hi, everybody. Yeah, we have this beautiful 75-year-old ash tree in our front yard, about, I'd say, 15, 18 feet away from the front of the house. And I was being a little proactive, cutting it down before it got too bad with the ash borers. And I waited about 2 years, only 2 years, and I bought a red maple. I bought it at a big box store, so it was only about, I'd say, maybe it was skinny, and it was about 6 feet high, and the pot was maybe, you know,
we may have lost.
Hello?
I'm sorry, we lost you for a second. We've got that. And you are you having problems with the tree roots of that maple?
Yeah, the tree roots, yeah, they're kind of on the surface. A lot of them are on the surface. The tree is really healthy. It's grown in the last 5 years. It's about 15 feet high, and it's beautiful, except that the roots are kind of at the surface, and also there's a lot of branches coming up kind of low to the ground. Can I correct it?
Yeah, well, you're going to have problems correcting the roots, I think, Lisa.
Yeah. The roots are just, that's something that is pretty much going to happen with maples. A lot of people opt to not grow grass under maples, at least maybe not under the canopy. And instead, you can use some wood chips, but not very deep. Or better yet, shredded bark, mulch, and some kind of ground cover so that you don't hit roots with the mower. But yeah, that is really common with maples. Now, the branches low to the ground, you can keep those on for a couple of years, and unless you're talking about suckers that are coming off of the root system. Are you talking about something that's coming up parallel with the trunk, or are you talking about just low branches on the trunk?
It's mostly parallel. They don't seem to be coming from the roots. It's about 6 inches up off the ground. And I do have, and it's a very open area, that I do have some mulch, so I've been keeping that open. Yeah, and I was just wondering, some of those branches are real healthy, but they're really too low to make it really look very good. So I'm thinking,
Most likely, but I'd love it if you would send me a photo before I make that recommendation. So you can send that to me at the Dane County Extension office. If you just Google Lisa Johnson, Dane County Extension, you should be able to find me. Ideally, you would want to do that pruning during the dormant season. And you don't want to take off any more than 25% at any one time. Not really knowing what your tree exactly looks like right now, I'd like to be able to see it before I advise how much of it to take off.
Okay. Vivian, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Shoot a picture of that to Lisa at the Dane County Extension office, and she will give you a more complete answer, I bet. Thank you very much for calling. Bob in Iola, we'll go to you next. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how are you doing, guys?
Good.
You guys are my heroes. Hey, listen, I've had an organic farm for 40 years, so I think I know what I'm doing, but I got a problem here. Blueberries. An established planting, and they're 15 years old, and recently they've started dying off. And I pulled up the first one, the dead one, and I have all my plants surrounded by hardware cloth to keep the voles from decimating them. And this root ball was the same dimension as the hardware cloth. It mirrored it. Have you heard of zinc toxicity affecting it? I pulled up all the rest of the hardware cloth, and they seem to be doing better. Clues.
My thought is maybe the hardware cloth is retaining moisture underneath that, and so there's not an incentive for the roots to grow out farther because they've, for a while at least, have been getting sufficient water. I don't know about the zinc issue. If you're concerned about that, my recommendation would actually be to have the plant tissue tested for zinc levels to see if there's any sort of indication of that being a problem. It's oftentimes difficult to diagnose those sorts of problems. Do the roots look as though they're really massive and intertwined and growing all together?
And actually growing out to the hardware cloth, turning around and growing back in.
Yeah. And again, I'm wondering whether it's a water relationship.
Are you saying that with the hardware cloth that you have it sunk into the ground? Is that what I'm understanding?
It's down about an inch to keep the voles from digging under, but it doesn't go as deep as the roots. And I only dug up the one because it was dead, and I pulled the rest of them off. I figured I'd reinstall them on the winter. And I use hardware cloth on all my fruit trees, and I always have, and
it's always
done well.
Yep. I recommend that too.
The pH in this case, because I'm trying to keep it below 6, I was wondering if there might be an extraction of the zinc.
I have heard there was somebody who was concerned about solder on galvanized wire that had asked me a similar question this year, and I did some research on it, and there can be, I think, some zinc, but I really doubt that that's what the issue is. I'm wondering, what kind of soil do you have? And did you use when you planted it, did you put some extra compost in it or something, and then it's surrounded by, heavy clay? That would be something, sometimes if there are two different textures of soil, you can have roots circling or turning back.
40 years ago, I got a background in soil when I went to college before I started this farm. And if technically, the soil is a Kennan bouldery B. The boulders are out. The native pH of the soil is 5-6, so it's perfect for blueberries. It was supplemented with regular sulfur, not aluminum sulfate.
Right, because that gets toxic.
My pH is right. Anyway, some of the plants that didn't have the cages on are doing fine, or the cages are big. It goes it surrounds an entire 6-foot plant because they're big plants. They're in the 20 years. Anyway, I just was looking for a clue, and you guys give me some ideas.
It's possible. I would have to do some research on that, though. But interesting.
For sure.
I don't know what. Yeah, I'm not sure either. Are the ones that are still alive, are they all the same vintage? Are they all planted at the same time?
Some were planted in 98 and some were planted in 2007. The 2007 group, because they were small enough to put a 36-inch hardware cloth around, are the ones that are suffering. The previous ones that have... the hardware cloth is 8x6, so I'm fencing the voles out of the entire area. And anyway, you guys have given me an idea about that sampling plant tissue itself. So
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Good luck, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Vern in Eau Claire called to ask when he could transplant the seedlings that spring up around it. His big white pine tree, right? When can he transplant them?
I take it these are pine seedlings that are around. Ideally, that would be spring, but I guess I would avoid fall, but spring or early summer would be the best time.
Okay. David in Nina, your turn. Hi, David.
Hi there. So I recently learned that it's better to water less frequently and deeply rather than frequently and shallowly, or at least that's what, you know, the I found on the internet. But so far in the summer, I've been watering every morning for what I think is enough. So I'm worried that I don't know if I should change my watering pattern, because if I've been doing it frequently but shallowly, have I like set the roots off on the wrong foot and like watering deeply won't help? My immediate thought is I have a garden and I have some like flower boxes on the deck, and my zinnias were doing really well when I was just watering them every day. But then when I was trying to like wait a couple of days or two or three days and then water them more deeply, a lot of the flowers started dying. The leaves pick right back up after I water them. But I'm wondering if I can change up the watering patterns in general, if I should, or if there's like a different, if I should do different things for the ground garden and the flower pots.
Yeah.
So you're using the same technique on your container plants that you are in ground. Is that what I'm hearing?
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. I mean, for like 40 some years, I've been doing this for two. So I'm a real newbie at all this.
Okay. So you're watering your container plants every day, and you're also watering your in-ground plants every day. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. Although the past like 3-4 days, I've been trying to go a day without it and then watering them again because of what I learned. But I'm concerned that I just can't make the switch easily.
Yeah, and that may be the case. Now, if you were talking about seedlings or seeds, you know, that you're trying to get to germinate, then, you know, yeah, those do need to be kept pretty moist while they're starting. But what I am concerned about is that you may be having it, depending on your soil type, too wet in ground. And with the pots, that can also happen. And if you've damaged the roots by watering too much, you might have actually lost root to, this would be Brian's territory with root rot. And that might also explain some wilting. I guess I'd, if you've been growing them in that pot all year, if you can kind of tip it over a little bit and just take a look at the roots to see how they're doing. Normally, I would recommend beginning of the year that you are only watering things in containers every couple of days. When it gets dry, you know, you stick your finger in, or you can buy a little water meter that will tell you what the moisture level is. And if you, as you get later in the year and the roots start to grow and use up the amount of soil volume that's available, then you may need to be at this point in time watering every day if it's been really hot. So it's hard to know without, you know, knowing how many plants are in the pot, and what kind of pot, and what kind of plants they are. And but yes, in general, you do want to water deeply till the water runs through the pot, and then you let it go for a couple of days, ideally. Again, unless you're starting seeds in a pot, then you might need to water every day for a little while until they germinate. I'm sure that sounded really confusing.
Thank you very much, David, for calling. Appreciate your call. Susan in Fitchburg, your turn.
Hi, it just happened by accident yesterday. I turned on WHA TV and I got into the middle of a talk by Doug Tallamy, and I understand he's going to be a guest on your show this coming week. I'm kind of responding to the lady that was calling about her cottonwood tree that's going to be going down, and she wants to choose a new tree. And Doug gave this really nice talk about planting native trees, native plants. And as an example, he was saying that an oak tree can support over 100 types of different caterpillars, which, of course, turn into butterflies or also feed birds. whereas a ginkgo tree hosts no caterpillars. So I think when a person is choosing a tree for their yard, it's important to choose something native. And he mentioned that there's going to be a list coming out by the end of the year. I don't remember what organization he was talking about, but there's an effort to produce a list for each county of Wisconsin, which will list the preferred trees and plants to plant in your yard. And I'm just really excited to get that.
Thank you very much, Susan. Doug Tallamy will be with us this coming Wednesday from 11:45 to 12:30. So he's been mentioned several times over the last month or so or two. Various people on Garden Talk have mentioned, other guests have mentioned his name as well. And so we're looking forward to talking with him. But the native trees, a good point. Thank you very much. Oak trees are fabulous trees to begin with, and as an example of a local tree. So thanks, Susan, very much. And Doug, again, will be on Wednesday from 11:45 to 12:30. Right now, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston are our guests. You know, this might be a good time just to mention that we're partnering with UW-Madison's Extension Horticulture Program to really learn more about your experience listening to Garden Talk. So we'd love to find out what you learned during the show and how you'll put it to use. And we also are looking for your ideas for future Garden Talk topics. So we got a very short, a little survey, taking 2 minutes maybe. Go to WPR.org/Larry. It's WPR.org/Larry. Click on today's show note for a link to that little survey. So WPR.org/Larry and go to today's show note for a link. Or you could go directly to go.wisc.edu/radio, any browser, go.wisc.edu/radio, any browser. It'll just take you a couple minutes to fill that out. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison. So great to have both of them with us. Join in. Questions at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take another call. Don in Madison, your turn now. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I've got a pine tree. It's probably about 3 or 4 years old. It's coming in really well. It's got 3 leaders. I'm assuming I should be taking off 2 of them and leave the dominant one. But I was just wondering if that is what I should do and when I should do it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes, definitely. Yep. You got it right. You should only have 1 leader on an evergreen like that. Ideally you would do that pruning in spring, but you could still do it at this time of year, but I wouldn't do it much later than about now. Because when you do take off something, you end up stimulating more growth, and we don't want to do that too much later in the year than now. But, you know, they do a lot of Christmas tree farm pruning in July. They do a lot of shearing and so on. So I wouldn't put it off too much longer if you wanted to do it yet this growing season, but you could certainly certainly
good little weekend task for you, Don, this coming weekend. Yeah. There you go. Jim in Trempolo, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks. Hey, I kind of got an interest in chinquapin oaks, and I'm having a lot of trouble finding them around the nurseries in my area. I've checked with quite a few, and they just don't carry them. So I wondered if that's because it's not, you know, a good tree for this area.
You're in Trempolo.
Believe it's zone 4, but I would need to check that. It's certainly a really beautiful oak. We actually have one that's in our teaching garden here at the Dane County Extension Office. And I am just checking to see. It's not the fastest growing one, but of course, you know, most oaks are not all that fast growing. So let's see here. For some reason, I don't know exactly why it is hard to find, but it should.
I find a reference to zone 5, Lisa.
Okay. Well, then, I mean, it's hard to find down here, too. I think it's just not very commonly popular. Grown for some reason.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, because it's really quite beautiful. It might be something that you might have to order online. I'm not sure whether Trempolo is zone 4, though, or whether it's zone 5. I have a feeling it's probably zone 4.
Zone 4.
Yeah.
I believe.
Okay. So that might be a little bit too cold for your area, but it sure is a beautiful oak tree. And speaking of oaks, the reason that I didn't recommend an oak for the person previously calling was because she said she didn't want acorns and squirrels. And Doug Tallamy's awesome book, Bringing Nature Home, I definitely recommend that for anybody. You know, being a horticulturist, though, I do recommend non-native as well as native trees, as long as they're, and shrubs and flowers and so on, as long as they're properly suited for the area and not not invasive. But I do, I think all of the others that I recommended were native. I do recommend native plants whenever we can. For sure.
And I had to say that I liked your choices because they tend to be pretty disease resistant. They don't have a lot of disease problems. So.
Yeah, there's a matrix of things that goes into choosing a tree. And, you know, it's a high value item that's going to be around for a long time. And of course, you know, you want to make sure that it's going to fit the space, that it's going to, if you want fall color, that it's got that it's going to, if you want it for shade, does it work in the pH and moisture level of the soil? Right. Are there disease or insect problems? So there's always a lot of factors, which is why that publication that Laura Gell put together on factors for choosing landscape, woody landscape plants is such a great one, because it does go through all of those things. And certainly whether a plant is native or non-native is something to factor in. My own landscape has a blend of native and non-native species, and I do love to see all the pollinators on the native but also non-native plants.
Yeah, and I have to say my mind always goes to the potential problems, because that's the world that I live in.
That's my thing.
And so anytime I see oaks, I love oaks. I love oaks of all kinds, but again, my concern with oaks is oak wilt, which is a lethal disease. And so you can have a tree that's been around for a long time, and if it ends up becoming infected, that tree typically will have to be removed.
And I know that you always say, show me a plant and I'll show you a disease.
Yeah, that will take it out.
It's hard to find something that doesn't have some kind of problem.
Oh, boy. Well, Susan and Jim, thank you. Susan in Greenville, we'll go to you. Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Oh, Well, I love your show, and I'll listen to it as often as I can. And I have a problem, or no, a question. I have a serviceberry tree, which I effly love. The birds love it. It's wonderful. And it's planted, I would say, too close to the house. And it's been there for 26 years. Well, now I'd like to know what to feed it. It needs, I'd like to encourage it because I want it to stay here and be happy.
Is it happy now?
I'm surprised. Pardon? Yeah, it is.
Is it happy now?
Yeah, right. And, you know, but the side of the house was sort of nothing but fill when they planted it.
Lisa, you know, what do you think?
It's kind of a myth that we need to necessarily feed trees. You know, if the tree is doing fine now, if you're not seeing any nutritional issues, I don't usually recommend for woody plants adding a lot of fertilizer if it's growing well and so on. I get more concerned about lack of moisture, frankly, with a lot of our plants. I wouldn't say that unless it looks like it needs something, if the color is off or if it doesn't seem to be growing well, then you might want to look into what's causing that. And it might not even be nutrition. It might be your soil type or something like that. But if it looks like it's growing well, I wouldn't even do that.
There you go.
Serviceberries are great plants, again, from a disease perspective. I see very few problems on that particular tree. They're a tough plant and such a beautiful little tree as well.
I love it. I've got one in my yard. We have a few at the teaching garden. The one problem that we end up with occasionally at the teaching garden is lace bugs. And that, if you didn't know what to look for, if you didn't flip over the leaf and see these little guys, you might think that it was a nutritional issue because they're sucking insects and they cause speckling on the leaves. But yeah, I agree with you, Brian. I rarely see any kind of problem. And like Susan was saying, the birds love it and the pollinators love the flowers in early spring. The fall color's beautiful. The shape is beautiful. The bark is, I mean, what's not to love?
And if you can get to the fruits before the birds, you can make killer muffins from them.
Oh,
there you go. Susan, thank you. Carolyn in La Crosse, you have a quick question.
Hi. I have two maple trees in my yard, and because of my electrical wires, I have to have them trimmed. And I have two questions. One, every year in the fall, both trees get a black circle in all of the leaves.
Yep.
And number two, it was mentioned that if you trim a tree out, you should only trim it out a quarter of the branches. Is that true?
Yeah, I'll take care of the leaf problem that you're seeing. So black spots on the leaves, is that what you're seeing?
Yes.
Yes, okay. It's probably a disease, fungal disease called tar spot. It's very common on maples. And there, if you have our native maples, you'll see a solid black spot on the leaves that's a bit raised. And if you look very carefully, it'll look like somebody left a thumbprint in the middle of the tarry area. If you're dealing with something like a Norway maple, which is an introduced maple, it'll be a more diffuse kind of cluster of small tarry spots in an area. Totally cosmetic disease. Don't worry about that. Just try to be really careful in the fall to clean up the leaf debris from the tree and get that out of your yard. If you're in an area where you can potentially burn the leaves, not particularly environmentally friendly, but that's a great way to get rid of disease materials. You can bury the material, or if you're a really good hot composter where you do composting properly, then you can actually compost that material. But you're going to see a certain level of that disease every year, but just learn how to ignore it because it's not a serious problem.
Yeah, there we go.
And the pruning question, generally it is recommended to only take 25% of the total canopy of a tree when you're pruning it. Now you can expand that to more like 30% if you're looking at fruit trees, but for shade trees, in order to avoid a lot of stress It's recommended no more than 25% of the total canopy.
There you go, Carolyn. Thank you so much for calling. Just to mention again, we're partnering with UW Extension's Hort program to learn more about your experiences listening to Garden Talk. Love to find out what you learned during the show and how you're going to put it to good use, as well as give us some ideas for future Garden Talk topics. Just go to WPR.org/Larry. It's WPR.org/Larry. Click on today's show note for a link, or you can go to go.wisc.edu/radio to put that in any browser. Just take you a couple minutes to fill it out, and we would really love to have that information from you. Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson back with us. Brian directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Lisa is a UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. So what gardening questions are on your mind? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Again, love to hear from you. Frank in Wauwatosa wonders why his crabapple trees lose their leaves all summer long. They're 15 years old. Do they have a disease?
My guess is probably yes, and it's probably apple scab. It's a very common disease in crabapples and apples. In certain areas of the state, we kind of had some rain right around the time when the trees were leafing out. And that's an optimal time for infections to occur. And then once those initial infections occur, the fungus continues to generate more spores that will reinfect the leaves when we have a wet period. And the infections can get severe enough that the leaves will yellow and drop. It makes the tree look bad, from an overall health standpoint, I've seen lots of crab apples that survive perfectly well for many, many years with apple scab that defoliates the tree every year. So oftentimes my recommendation to clients is if you want to keep the tree, kind of learn how to live with that leaf loss. If it really bugs you to have a tree that's defoliated mid-season, then consider replacing it with a newer variety that's been bred for resistance. Otherwise, if the existing tree, you want it to have a lot of leaves and you want to keep it because maybe it has some sentimental value, you're really down to using fungicides on a routine basis, which gets really old quickly. You have to start applications when the leaves first come out and then make applications about every week to 10 days thereafter, as long as we have really wet weather. So that gets to be very old hat very quickly, particularly for homeowners. So I would say either live with it or consider replacement.
Chuck in Viroqua emailed that he's curious what you think of these root feeding stakes that you pound in around the drip line of trees. He's used them in the past, not sure if they're effective or necessary. Lisa, what do you think?
I'd say probably not either or necessary. The thing with the stakes is that you tend to get diffusion of the fertilizer product right around the stake, but it doesn't spread out over a big area like a granular product would, whether that's an organic or whether it's a traditional type of fertilizer. And if under certain conditions, you could possibly even get root burn because it is so concentrated in that particular area. So particularly with new plants, I wouldn't recommend it. And with older trees and shrubs, again, we usually don't recommend a lot of fertilizer.
There you go, Chuck. Thank you for that question. Jean in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I have a large maple tree, and it's lost almost all the bark on the lower part of the trunk. But the upper part of the tree seems healthy. And I'm wondering if it is and what that could be caused that.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect the upper part of the tree to remain healthy for an extended period if you've lost all the bark on the lower trunk, because the bark is actually protecting the water conducting tissue underneath. And if that bark is coming off, that means that a large proportion of the water conducting tissue is damaged. And eventually that's going to limit water movement to the top of the tree, and that top of the tree is going to die back. There are several things that can potentially cause that. Sometimes with maples, if they tend to get what are called frost cracks, which are vertical cracks in the main trunk, that can allow certain types of fungi to get in underneath there, and that can cause loosening of bark. Also, girdling roots are another thing. Again, roots that grow around the trunk, that can put stress on the bark, which will make it loosen and eventually come off. And then from a true disease standpoint, there's a disease called armillaria root disease. The fungus kind of comes in through the roots and forms a fungal kind of mat, thin layer of fungal tissue between the bark and the wood. And that will oftentimes lead to loosening of the bark as well. What I watch for that is mushroom formation around the base of the tree or in the root zone. You see little kind of honey-colored mushrooms. That could be what you're dealing with. And that's can be a relatively serious disease, because that fungus eventually will produce these root-like structures. They're fungal tissue, but they look like roots. And those are formed out into the soil. And this is the way for the fungus to spread to other trees. And our malaria has a fairly wide host range. So I'm not very optimistic long-term for the survivability of your maple. So you may want to plan on replacing it and think about it, quite frankly, now before you have to take it out.
Gene, sorry for that news, but thank you for calling. Susan in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Susan.
Hello. I frequent a dog park frequently, several of them. And I know that Dane County has been working on establishing oak savannas in a lot of these. And I'm just wondering with oak wilt, how wise that is. And then I have another related question.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to do. Like Lisa, I think natives are really cool. And reestablishing oak savanna, which was kind of the predominant ecosystem here in southern Wisconsin, is, I think, a really cool idea. But again, because I'm a plant pathologist and I run a clinic where I see, you know, dead and dying plants all the time, whenever I hear oak, the first thing that comes to my mind is oak wilt. And the main thing with oak wilt is keep the trees healthy, prune them if you need to prune at all, would be to prune at the proper time of the year. We usually recommend winter pruning for oaks. And that's because the oak wilt fungus is moved around by sap beetles, and those are active through much of the growing season. And it doesn't take long for these sap beetles to identify a tree with a wound. There is research that indicates that sap beetles can visit a wounded oak tree within about 10 minutes of the wound forming. So if you happen to prune them during the growing season, when these insects are active, they can very easily move in the oak wilt fungus. And if you have storm damage, again, that would be a situation where I would be inclined to come in and kind of prune off the broken branch, but then immediately paint over that wound. And anytime, for whatever reason, if you do need to prune during the growing season, have a can of paint right next to you and prune over that wound. That'll make it less attractive to the insects. But I love oaks. It's just that I oftentimes see ones that are in decline and that do have oak wilt.
Thank you, Susan. Oh, you had another question?
Yep.
I had another question. So at another dog park, I noticed earlier in the spring, there were two of the oaks, and there's, you know, they've planted a variety of oaks, but two that looked very similar that had clearly been attacked by something. I mean, their leaves were almost decimated. Now, the new growth looks okay, but I was just wondering why those, that one kind of oak might attract whatever it was.
It may not be an insect. It may be oak tatters. That is a physiological condition caused by cold weather. It also can, there's some indications that it might be a reaction to early season herbicide spray. There is a fact sheet on it. Brian, do you have one at the PDDC, or is it?
I have the tatters at my clinic website, yeah. pddc.wisc.edu.
That would be my thought, that's probably what it is.
And I did see a fair amount of problems. If you notice this around Memorial Day weekend, we had that cold snap that occurred around that time. And there were trees that had leafed out, and it got cold enough to cause some issue death on the leaves. And then because it was so severe, then the trees pushed a second set of leaves. So that might be some of what you're seeing as well. If it were insect, my guess would be maybe something like gypsy moth, although they tend to feed on a wide range of different types of oaks. But if you're out there again, kind of look around and see if you see any indication of larvae or any other insects on the trees.
Yeah, they'd be laying down egg masses about now, too, if they were right about this time. You'd see these kind of little blackish...
Kind of buff-colored, as I recall.
Yeah,
buff-colored.
Right.
Yeah.
The caterpillars themselves, I think, are pretty much at either the pupal stage or I haven't seen any adult moths yet. My next door neighbor has gypsy moths on their tree, so I've been waiting to see if there are any adults that appear. But I've certainly had my share of caterpillars to kill off this year.
Yeah, yep, for sure. Susan, thank you. Appreciate your call. Edmund in Appleton, your turn. Hi.
Yes, good morning. I planted a elm tree, and, well, I didn't. The landscapers did. And then, of course, they didn't water it. When I got to see it, I watered it profusely. It came back. Wasn't doing well when they didn't water it. Then I come back a couple days later, and I discovered Japanese beetles have attacked this poor tree. So I went at the beetles with dish soap and a hand pump, but I got so sure that soap was good for the tree.
Did the soap damage the tree? Might have the leaves, possibly?
The leaves were all eaten up by the beetles. Mm. Now, I was a little generous with the soap because I'm not a big one on the toxics. So I was generous with the soap, and sure enough, the beetles were dropping like rain. But maybe I was a wee too generous, eh?
Are you seeing effects on the leaves? Is that why you're asking about that? Are they like turning pale or brown or?
They're brown after they were eaten at the leaves. And so I went back and watered it before this recent heavy rain. And when I did, the mulch was showing there was soap bubbles, which is an indication I might have gone over the top.
Yeah, that probably is. One thing you might want to do is use insecticidal soap. That is, it's a soap product, but it's meant for being used on foliage, whereas regular dish soap can sometimes have phytotoxic effects and can, especially during hot weather, cause more damage than, well, I can't say more damage than Japanese beetles because they are destructive, but I'm glad that you noticed the tree was dry and you watered it. You noticed that it had beetles and you tried to take care of that. So good for you for being a good environmental steward. There are some, I remember a few years ago, we had a tour of in the Madison area, a bunch of arborists, and we were looking at different varieties of elms and, you know, how susceptible they were to Japanese beetles or how resistant they were, as well as, you know, resistant to Dutch elm disease, not resistant. And some of them are unfortunately pretty susceptible, which is too bad because, you know, they're beautiful trees. But I would try. You said there was heavy rain, so hopefully that has dispersed the soap. But I guess in the future, and you may have more beetles because they have such a long season, I would purchase some insecticidal soap, and because that's better formulated for leaf application than your dish soap.
All right. There you go, Edmund. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Judy in Lanesboro, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Oh, good afternoon. I'm calling because of a problem I have with my tomatoes. I have 9 tomatoes. I'm standing out here looking at them. 3 beefsteaks and 6 celebrity. They are in a north-south row. The first 4 look gorgeous. They blossomed out. I've got nice blossoms on them. And then the next 5 are spindly stems. The leaves are rolling and curling. They almost feel leathery. I planted them the same. I've watered them the same. I put down newspaper. When I planted them, I put newspaper around them, and then we have mulched with grass clippings. So nothing is touching dirt. When it rains, you know, I'm not getting dirt splashed up on them, which I have learned that in the past is an issue for disease. But, you know, I guess what I want to know is, are these a goner? I mean, they've got, they have blossoms on them. So is there something that I could use? Well, first of all, Brian, do you think this is a fungus, or what's your thoughts?
You mentioned that you'd use grass clippings. Did you use the grass clippings just around the plants that are showing the symptoms?
No, they're on all 9 of them.
All 9 of them, okay.
Are the ones showing the symptoms one variety or the other, or are they both varieties?
They would be mainly the celebrity, but I have... I would have one of the celebrities looks really good, and then the next 5 in the row would be celebrity. But one is coming really well, and then this is on the north end of the row is where I have the issue.
Mm-hmm. Did you or your neighbor?
No, I'm in the country, so my neighbors are far away.
Okay, so they're not, nobody's applied any lawn chemicals
no.
in the area then.
No.
Do you have agricultural?
Yeah, that's the next one.
Yeah, do you have any agricultural fields close to you?
Not not where these tomatoes are planted. I mean, I don't even see, there wouldn't be a drift even from from our fields.
Yeah, although the drift can occur for long distances, so I wouldn't totally rule that out. The curling, weird growth that you're talking about, the sort of things that I normally associate with that are herbicides, growth regulator herbicides, and those are common in both agricultural weed control products and also turf grass products for controlling broadleaf weeds. The other possible thing would be viruses. Have you seen any sort of insect activity on the plants at all?
You know, I'm turning over the leaves right now, and I see nothing as far as an insect.
Okay.
I don't notice anything there.
Okay. Does anyone who handles the plants smoke by any chance?
No.
Okay, that's good. Because there is one particular virus that you can move, that you can pick up in tobacco products.
Any black walnuts in the area?
No.
Okay.
Nope.
No. Well, is it?
Yeah.
Would it be a soil thing? You know, rocks or something under the soil that might be affecting the roots in that part, in that area?
Crop to this was, I had zucchini squash here and cucumbers.
Okay.
And actually, this is a little raised bed that's on the edge of the garage, or on the, you know, it would be on the west side of the garage. So it gets good. It was a rose bed at one time, and we decided, we need a spot where we could, our garden isn't really huge, but I was cognizant of the idea of rotating crops, and I felt like my tomatoes were not, we weren't able to rotate our tomatoes enough to really get away from maybe some residual factors. So that's why we changed this bed then into a vegetable garden. And I was expecting some really good tomatoes this year.
Yeah.
We may not be able to answer this one.
Yeah,
but
there is a possibility that there could be some sort of soil contaminant in that area. I can't rule that out, that might be causing some problems. This would be one where I'd like to see some photos of the plants to see what they really look like. Because sometimes when someone describes something, I hear one thing and they're describing something else. So
it's easy to get a picture in your head.
That doesn't look anything like what it actually looks like. So you'd be welcome to send in some photos to the clinic if you're interested in pursuing things more. And if you just do a search on UW-Madison Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, they'll come to my webpage. But that might be a better way for this particular problem to try to figure it out.
Yeah, that makes the most sense. Good luck, Judy. Go ahead and send some photos and let Brian take a look at it. Oh my gosh, here we are coming up to time on the show. Just a quick reminder, we're doing this little survey about what you might have learned during the show and how you'll put it to use. And we're looking also for some ideas for future garden talk topics. So there's a little questionnaire. Go to WPR.org/Larry. Click on today's show note for a link. Or you can go to go.wisc.edu/radio, and it'll just take you a couple of minutes. Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, our guests. Always great to have them. And they will be back, and we'll talk with them again. Tech expert Jesse LeGru is back on Monday to talk about, among other things, choosing wireless headphones and why they may or may not work for you. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.